Why don't you join me in the book of Ephesians? We're going to continue our study in Ephesians chapter 2. We're working our way through Ephesians verse by verse, and we're really up to the second part of the final part of chapter 2, verse 2. But I'm going to read the first three verses of chapter 2. I'll briefly review what we've covered so far in those verses, and then we should be able to finish through verse 3 tonight. Chapter 2, verse 1. "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest." Now, what we've covered so far in this section, and we're right up to in verse 2, right after the phrase, "the prince of the power of the air," is where we stopped. But what we've covered so far is that Paul, after in chapter 1, giving us, without question, the single greatest overview of the great plan of God in salvation, both from eternity past all the way through history and on into eternity future, he shifts gears here at the beginning of chapter 2, and he takes the believer's attention backwards now. At the end of chapter 1, he's looking forward into eternity to come and the great plan that's going to be fulfilled in Christ and our part in that plan. And then at the beginning of chapter 2, he stops and he says, "Now, before we get there, though, let's stop and remember where we came from." And these first three verses are a description of our former life, who we were outside of Christ, apart from Christ, who we were spiritually, what the nature of our spiritual condition was in relationship to God and relationship to his plan and purpose. And it's really a sad picture when you look at these first three verses. It's just a snapshot of what our lives were like before salvation. I mean, sad really doesn't fully communicate the depth of how tragic our lives were and what our lives were really like. And he does this not to, in a sense, depress the believers in Ephesus or to depress us. I know that it's not uncommon, even in the Christian community, that when we do Bible study and when we come together and talk about the things of the Lord, the natural tendency is for us to want to talk about things that are more upbeat, things that will encourage our hearts, things that will strengthen our hearts, and things that are more pleasant to think about and to talk about. But there's a benefit to stopping like Paul has us do in this section and to rehearse and remember what things really were like before. And the benefit is it establishes a right framework or context for our hearts to fully appreciate what God has accomplished in our salvation, what he did in sending his son, the price that he really paid in order for us to be restored to him and to be brought into a new life relationship with him and to have our lives rebuilt and strengthened and prepared for the great eternal plan that he has for us in the future. The analogy I've given already is the analogy of the diamond merchant that's showing his diamonds against the backdrop of the dark background of the black velvet. And that in a sense is what Paul is doing here. He's showing just how glorious salvation is by first preparing our hearts by remembering just how dark our lives were apart from him. Starting in verse 4, which we haven't gotten to yet in chapter 2, he's going to shift back now to addressing salvation and the great and glorious thing that God has accomplished for us in Christ. But we need to fully appreciate what he has done for us. And so in this little section, we've seen so far that the nature of our spiritual condition before we were saved is encapsulated or captured by one single word, and that is our spiritual condition prior to Christ, prior to salvation, was we were dead, spiritually dead. Physically alive, breathing, moving, thinking, speaking, relating, but spiritually at the core of who we were, disconnected from the life of God, spiritually dead. And not only were we dead, of course the cause or the source of our spiritual death was our own fault. It wasn't that we were innocent victims. We were dead in our trespasses and sins. But we were also, in our spiritual death, we were under the influence of three great spiritual influences that were affecting every day of our lives and every moment of every day of our lives before we came to know the Lord. And when I say they're great influences, I don't mean great in a good sense. I mean great in the bad sense. Just like a person can ingest a certain substance that causes such a severe influence on their thinking and on their behavior that people are arrested for being under the influence. And those are just natural and physical influences. These are spiritual influences that subtly but powerfully influenced every thought, every word, every behavior, every habit, every day of our lives. And those three great influences, we're familiar with the terms. And the order that we're familiar with is the world. And we saw that the world here is the world not as a planet, the world not as a population of people, but the world as a spiritual system that's set in rebellion against God and against His kingdom, a fallen world. Then the second of the great influence is the devil, who is identified with a unique title in this passage, unique because it's the only place in the New Testament that it's used, or actually anywhere in the Bible, in which he is identified as the prince of the power of the air. And I won't go back into the details of that difficult to interpret phrase, but if you're interested in learning more about that, get last week's message titled The Prince of the Power of the Air, or listen to it on our sermon audio page on the internet. There's free downloads available there. And then the third of these great influences is what we're going to be focused on tonight, which is the flesh. So picking up where we left off, let me read again verse 2 and 3. In which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. All right, so our next phrase that we're digging into and studying here is the phrase, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. The spirit at work in the sons of disobedience. All right, the first thing we need to do is we need to identify this spirit. This is not a good spirit, of course, because this is a spirit that's at work. And the word at work is the Greek word that we get our English word energy from. And it literally means to energize. The spirit that is energizing, so to speak, the sons of disobedience. And this is a direct connection with the last phrase that we studied. When we read, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to our, in a sense, under the influence of the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now energizing or at work in the sons of disobedience, the phrase the spirit is pointing back not directly to Satan himself, but it's pointing back to his influence. So we could call this a reference to satanic influence in the life of the unbeliever. And that influence is active. And it's active to energize the thoughts, the words, the behavior of a specific group of people. And that group of people is identified twice in our three-verse section here by two different names. Here in this phrase, or in this verse, it's the phrase is the sons of disobedience. And I'm going to connect that directly with a second phrase, which I'm using as the title tonight, and that is children of wrath. And those two phrases from verse 2 and verse 3 are just two different descriptions of the same group. I just want us to be clear that Paul is describing the same group of people twice using slightly different descriptives. Now, in this case, the sons of disobedience is kind of an unusual phrasing. We use the phrase in this way, or the saying, the sons of, but it's something that it bears a little bit of explanation. Is disobedience a person? No. Can disobedience give birth to anyone directly as a person? No. And yet, there is a group of people who are called the sons of disobedience, which implies that disobedience is, in some sense, the parent or the father or mother of these particular sons. Like, if I had a family full of sons and I pointed to them and said, these are the sons of Tim, you would readily and quickly understand that. But if you're referring to the sons of disobedience, what does that mean? Well, how are we meant to understand it? It means that there's a particular group of people that are the offspring of a particular disobedience. And that particular disobedience we've already studied in this section. We understand that this is all tracing backwards in history, spiritually speaking, to the first great disobedience in human history. The disobedience of Adam in the Garden of Eden that set in motion, in a sense, opened the door for sin to enter the world and the corruption that came into the world on the heels of sin. And so the sons of disobedience are all of the children of Adam who were born according not to his pristine, unfallen likeness before he sinned, but all the sons of Adam who were born according to the fallen nature that he received once he sinned. The idea is that this is really describing both of these phrases, sons of disobedience and children of wrath, are both describing the entire human race without exception. And this is, I don't think, a big problem for us in our perspective, but it is a hurdle for some people. The reason being that there is a very common and very popular perspective that's actually become more and more in our culture and in our society, the dominant perspective, and that is that people, when they're born into this world, are born into this world as innocent and essentially good at heart. And I would say, in our culture anyway, that the majority of people now believe this. There was a time in our society and in our culture when our culture was more directly biblically influenced. People as a whole were more serious in their study of the Bible and in their appreciation of what the Bible teaches, in which it was commonly understood that people are born into this world with a spiritual condition already in force in their hearts and in their lives. But nowadays, when you talk to the average person on the street, even many people that claim to be Christian and claim to know the Lord and follow the Lord and even believe the Bible overall, tend to operate with this perspective that children are born into this world innocent, spiritually pure, that they are like a blank slate, spiritually speaking, and that if they become bad sometime during the course of their life, that they become bad not because of, this is their perspective, not because of nature, but because of nurture or the lack thereof. Meaning, if people are bad or become bad in this world, it's because they weren't raised properly. They weren't given the right advantages. They weren't taught properly. They had difficult circumstances growing up. And these various external influences working upon them caused them to eventually yield and become a bad person. The Bible doesn't teach that. Now, of course, there are in this world, because the world itself is fallen. There are many bad influences in this world. We're even talking about three great spiritual influences. But the idea is that these influences don't cause someone to be essentially good or essentially bad. We are born into this world in one condition or the other. You can't be kind of, biblically speaking, spiritually speaking, you can't be born into this world kind of good and kind of bad. If you're kind of good and kind of bad, from a biblical perspective, what are you actually? You're bad. It's like, and there's different analogies you could use to describe this, but it's like taking a glass of absolute pure spring water, and then you take just a little bit of gunk or garbage or dirt or some defiling physical element, and you put just some of that in the water. Now, do you have a glass of pure, clean water, or do you have, it's mostly water. Let's say I put 1%, you know, sewage, raw sewage, in a glass of absolutely pure water. It's still 99% pure, right? As soon as I put that 1% of raw sewage in there, as far as I'm concerned, I've ruined the entire glass of water. And honestly, as long as you know what I've just put in it, I can offer it to you, and you may be even thirsty, but you're going to choose not to drink that glass of water because it's no longer pure water. The sewage overwhelms the purity of the water, and it disseminates throughout the entire glass of water. It's not like the 1% just stays right on the top and we can skim it off and now we're back to pure. It doesn't work that way. And in the same sense, spiritually speaking, when Adam sinned and when the world through Adam fell into sin, it was taking the raw sewage of sin and adding it to what was previously an absolutely pure heart, created pure, created innocent. But that sewage of sin defiled the entire heart and the entire nature of man. And not just temporarily, and not just for him alone, but the Bible teaches us that every child that was ever born to Adam and Eve and to their children and to their children's children were born with this same spiritual element that was added in the fall. And so the result is they are born into a spiritual condition that is rightly described as sons of disobedience. That means they're inclined from day one toward disobedience. Now, the word disobedience here literally means disobedience, but it also means it has the sense of rebelliousness to it. It also carries the sense of obstinacy. Disobedient, not just in the sense of innocently, I violated a standard that God set and I made a mistake and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. But this is a kind of disobedience that's being described here in which the heart is set in the wrong direction. It's obstinately rebellious against God and his standards of what is right and what is holy. And so everyone that's born into this world is born into a spiritual category in which the Lord, not the rest of the world, it's not that the world looks at itself and says, you know what, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we really need to identify ourselves as sons of disobedience and later as children of wrath. This is God's evaluation of the spiritual condition of humanity as soon as the fall occurred. And ever since the fall, from that point forward that set something in motion that's still in force in the world around us, so that every child who is born into this world from that day until this day, right now, somewhere out there in this big city, not to mention the rest of the world, there is a child being born. That child has not done one single thing yet, right or wrong. That child has not thought one single thought, right or wrong. It's not spoken one single word, right or wrong. But that child is born with a spiritual condition already set in motion in their heart as a son of disobedience. And of course, you understand the term sons here isn't a gender-specific term. This is referring to males and females. It's not just that, you know, all of the males born into this world are really rotten to the core, and the females thankfully escape that. You know, they're pure and rosy, and there's no problems on that side. You know, this is a term which just refers to the parentage or the family connection that we all have as fallen human beings born into Adam's family. So we're born into this world, we're born fallen, we're born rebellious. The evidence of this is so clear and obvious, and yet it's amazing to me that the world looks at the evidence and somehow chooses to interpret it in a more favorable light. For instance, when a child is born into any family, I don't care what the family is, it could be the best family in the world or it could be the worst family. When that child grows old enough, you know, it's within the first year, you know, certainly within the first 2 years, when that child begins to grow old enough to be able to begin to understand what the parents are communicating to that child, and there's a sense of communication established, when the parent starts to teach and to train their young, seemingly innocent and pure child, what kind of things do we teach our children? What do we have to teach them? What's the very first lesson that every child is taught after the lesson of, you know, being able to identify their parents as mom and dad, you know, mama and papa? After that, what's the very first lesson every child has to be taught? Don't touch. That's a good one. Or no, that's usually the very first lesson that you have to establish in the heart of a child. Why don't we have to train and teach our children how to disobey? You know, have any of you ever had to make any effort and, you know what, you're too perfect, I want to balance you out, you know, you have only ever done exactly what I have dreamed and hoped and desired for you to do, let me teach you how to be a little bit wild and a little bit disobedient, just so that you can experience the full range of life. They disobey by nature. They disobey by natural inclination. It's already set in motion in the heart of a child. You know, it's like Proverbs talks to us that there's something that's set in the heart of a child. And that's, yes, it's identified as foolishness. And the instruction there in Proverbs, which we'll eventually get to in our study through Proverbs, is that something is required in order to drive out the foolishness that's born into or set into the heart of a child from birth. And that, of course, is the rod of correction. We don't use the rod of correction to teach them to disobey. We teach them to obey. And that's because there is this tide in the heart of every child, every single child, that is carrying them along like on a current. And that current is moving in one direction only, and that's in the direction of rebelliousness and disobedience. Now, that's not all that Paul has to say about this. Let's reread verse 2. In which we formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Then verse 3, among them we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. The idea here is that Paul wants to make sure that the church, that the Christians understand that this is not just his description of unbelievers. This is his description of every person born into this world. Whether you are now a believer or not, the reality is you came from this group before you were saved. Now, why would that be important for the believers to understand? I have talked with some believers. This isn't true of everyone. Some, right from day one in the experience of their salvation, have a really clear understanding of how lost they were because of just the circumstances of their life before they came to know the Lord. But there are some who come to know the Lord out of a set of life circumstances that's not necessarily as bad as others. That in terms of comparison with other people in the world, even before they were saved, they thought of themselves as a pretty good person. And I have met some who were born and raised in Christian households. And so from the very earliest time, their remembrance and their understanding is, as they've testified to me, as far as I remember, I always was a Christian. Now, is that true for anyone that's born into this world, that they just always were a Christian? And the truth is, no, I'm sorry. I don't care who you are. I don't care how good you were. I don't care how good your family was. I don't care how Christian your family was. There is no one born into this world as a Christian because, and we'll reemphasize this as we go through the book of Ephesians later, the most fundamental definition of a Christian in terms of the description of our spiritual condition is that a Christian is one who is born again. Now that second word in that phrase implies what? Born a second time. Now, everyone is born one time into this world. Some are born a second time while they're in this world. The first birth is natural and physical, and we all experience it. It's a shared experience. But that natural and physical first birth carries spiritual connotations because we are physically and naturally born into the category of sons of disobedience, from day one inclined to rebelliousness and disobedience. There are some who later, by the grace of God alone, are born a second time with a new spiritual birth. And that second spiritual birth, as we'll get into details on this later, of course, it deals with the elements of the first birth in a dramatic and powerful way. And we're going to have to look at that in some detail when we get to it to make sure we understand exactly how much the second birth changes the first birth and what are the boundaries and the limitations of that. But that's a study of a later time. What I want you to understand tonight, though, is that the fact that as a Christian you've been born again implies that there was a time before you became a Christian. And there was a time in which you lived in this world under the condition of your first birth only, until you experienced a second birth. And this is true even for children that are born into godly Christian homes. Every child born into this world the first time is born into a fallen condition, identifying them as sons of disobedience, and as we'll see in a moment, even children of wrath. And in order to avoid the consequences and the inevitable punishment that awaits the sons of disobedience and the children of wrath, only the second spiritual birth, the new birth, is what changes that inevitability. All right, so we are those who lived, as he says at the beginning of verse 3, among them. Among them who? Among the rest of humanity, the rest of the fallen world, the rest of the entire human race. Among them, we too all formerly lived. I'm running out of room here already. This is, again, not describing our present condition. It's describing our past, before Christ, before salvation. But we all, that's without exception, formerly lived. Now, the word lived just emphasizes that this wasn't just the way we were on a particularly bad day. You know, everybody has good days and everybody has bad days, even as Christians now, even as those who walk with the Lord. I have certain days where, you know, I obey the Lord all day long, the way that I'm supposed to. Not necessarily perfectly, but I obey the Lord. Then I have other days where, you know, I fall into the ornery streak of my former life and I don't obey Him as I should have. And I compromise or I cross lines in my heart, in my mind, in my words, in my behavior that I shouldn't be crossing. And I look back on the good days and I look back on the bad days and I say, well, you know, I'm so thankful, Lord, that the good days are outnumbering the bad days. And hopefully as I'm growing, the bad days are becoming fewer and fewer. But this is not describing our condition on former bad days. And on the rest of the days, we had it pretty well wired apart from Christ and apart from salvation. This is describing our everyday life and everyday experience, our everyday spiritual condition, the reality of what our life was really like. But thankfully, the emphasis is, this was our past, not our present. Which is leading up to what Paul is about to start to describe in verse 4 and beyond, and that is, when we were saved, something huge and something powerful and something dramatic took place. And it really changed us. It really changed us. Fully and completely changed us. That doesn't mean that there's no additional changes to be experienced after the moment of our salvation. But that salvation is a real and awesome change. But again, the focus here is not on our present, but it's on our past. And so we all formerly lived the same way that the rest of the human race lives. And how do they live? If we were to describe, how does the rest of the human race live? What are they like, spiritually speaking? What's the nature of their daily life and their daily experiences? You look at the behavior of people, and there's some people that are, you know, clearly and obviously bad. And then there are some people that seem to be fairly good. But biblically and spiritually, the Bible looks beyond the outward appearances and it looks at the core and what's really going on in the heart of a person. And there is a common shared experience in the case of every person that is living their life disconnected from the life of God because they're disconnected from Christ. And they have not yet experienced the grace and the mercy that comes only through the cross and the salvation that Christ has accomplished for us on the cross. And for them, this is what characterizes their life. Among them, and this was our former story also, we too all formerly lived in the lust of the flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. All right, so we see three. Well, let me get this on the board in a kind of a diagram. The diagram is of a tree. All right. And that's a pretty simple tree, but this line represents ground level. And below ground level would be what? Roots. And above ground level would be what? Fruits. Okay? We're talking roots and fruits here. In this description of, that is, the common spiritual condition of every unbeliever and was our common experience and condition before we came to know the Lord, there is a description of both a root and fruits. The root is described at the end of verse 3, but there are three fruits that are the product of that one bad root. And the three fruits are this: the lusts of our flesh, the desires of the flesh, and of the mind. So here's a fruit here. We'll call this the lust of flesh. And here's a fruit. We'll call this desires of flesh. And this one we'll call the desires of the mind. And all of these are bad fruits. What kind of bad fruits are we talking about? Well, these are all the expression of what is, and it's mentioned twice here for emphasis, of what is called the flesh. And the flesh is not specifically just the physical body in this context. The flesh is probably better described as what we would call our nature in its fallen condition before we were saved, before we were born again. So we'll call it the fallen nature. And what kind of things did the fallen nature do? You don't have to turn with me to this. I'll just read this as a quick reminder. We're all familiar with this passage. This is from Galatians 5, where Paul is contrasting what are called the fruit of the Spirit and the works of the flesh. And here is just the brief list of some of the works of the flesh. This is not an exhaustive list, but it's a completely representative list. The deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, meaning the list is not, it's not a complete list. It just gives us a good representation of the ways that the flesh expressed itself in our fallenness. So when you see a phrase like lust of the flesh, don't limit that to sensuality. That's one of the expressions that we saw in the list. But there are many other expressions that affect every aspect of our thoughts, our words, our behavior, our relationships, every part of our lives before we came to know the Lord. Now, all of these things are fed by one bad root. And the Bible teaches us in terms of principle that the fruit of any tree is fed by the root of that tree. It's the root that causes the fruit to be either good or bad. If the root is bad, the fruit of the tree is going to be bad. If the root's in good condition, the fruit of the tree is going to be in good condition. What's the root of this bad fruit-filled tree? Okay, nature. And a particular kind of nature, a bad nature, a fallen nature, where he says, the end of verse 3, the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. By nature means that this, when we're describing the nature of something, it's something deeper than just bad behavior. And it's so deep that even good training won't fully address it. You can modify a bad nature through training, but you can't change the nature of that thing. For instance, my wife and I own two dogs. We train our dogs. And I think that's a good thing. If you're going to own a dog, you should train your dog. So we train our dogs. No matter how well we train our dogs, no matter how much we modify their nature by the training that we give our dogs, the one thing we'll never be able to accomplish by our good training, hopefully good training, is what? We'll never be able to turn that dog into a cat or into a human being or into any other creature than a dog. It will always be a dog. It may be a well-trained dog, but it's still a dog. So its ability to do what it's trained, or I'm attempting to train it to do, is limited by its nature. For instance, my wife just taught one of our dogs a new trick to sit up for a treat, to sit up on his back legs and, with its forepaws up, ready to eat the treat. Because it's motivated by the treat, it does that. But she could train that dog from now until the end of its life to try to play chess with me, and she would not be able to accomplish the goal. Why couldn't she train my dog to play chess? Now, she could probably teach it with its paw or its nose to actually move pieces around on the board, but would it actually be playing chess? Why not? It's moving the pieces on the board, that's the rules of the game, right? Because there would be no understanding. The nature of the dog limits its ability. And so the idea here is that we were born into this world with a fallen nature. And it is true that training can limit the degree and the severity of the bad fruits that are produced by the bad nature of this tree. And that's why, and this is sometimes confusing for believers, but this is the truth of it. That's why some fallen people, some unsaved, unbelieving people seem better than others. For instance, not everyone that doesn't know the Lord is as bad as Adolf Hitler. We understand that. We get that. But what's the explanation of that? Well, I would say this. Adolf Hitler had the same nature that I did before I came to know the Lord. I was more limited in the degree and the severity of the bad fruits than Adolf Hitler was. But the truth is, I was just as lost as he was. I was just as fallen as he was. I was just as rotten at the core as he was. And yet, it's not something that everyone is ready to embrace because, you know, that says something pretty serious about what we were really like before we came to know the Lord. But as a believer, if you look back and recognize that, that doesn't diminish you ultimately. It only enhances the glory of the cross. It only enhances the awesome thing that the Lord did in saving us from such a rotten core and from such a fallen nature as this. Now, what are these fruits like? The lust of the flesh, the word lust is just simply, it's not specifically a sensual word. It just means a strong craving or desire. And it could be for anything. For instance, it could be for chocolate. But it could be for all kinds of evil and inappropriate things also. And the word desire is just inclination. And the idea here is that because we were fallen, our heart is already moving in a certain direction as we begin to grow up. And our cravings and our inclinations, both of the fallen nature and of the mind and of the physical body, led us into certain patterns of fallen behavior. But without exception, they never led us to greater holiness. They never led us to greater righteousness. Now, there are people in this world that attempt to establish a sense of personal identity in which they convince themselves that they are righteous apart from Christ. I've met people, I've talked to people, you have too, that think they're very good people without ever needing to be saved. And what is that? I mean, if they're acting in a pretty good way as far as the society is concerned, how do we accommodate that? How do we understand that? Well, what we need to understand is that's a sinful inclination or desire of their mind and of their flesh, just like some of the more overt sins are. It's just a more subtle one. The desire to appear as a good person apart from Christ is a desire which is born in the sinful nature as a fruit of pride and arrogance, which is, I am going to establish my own righteousness apart from God's righteousness. I'm going to make myself feel like a good person without needing to submit to the answer to my sin that God says is the only one that's a real answer. And so there are some expressions of sin that are more subtle than others. There are some that are more difficult to discern than others. But the reality is the shared experience and the shared condition of everyone who doesn't know the Lord is that of these desires of the flesh, these inclinations of both the flesh and the mind that lead them only in the wrong direction. Now, the last phrase, and we'll end our study with this, is this phrase that is the second description that connects to sons of disobedience, and that is, we were also known or called children of wrath. and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. Children of wrath is simply a description in which God is describing what is due or what is coming as an inheritance for this particular group of people at the end of their lives. And the inheritance of the sons of disobedience, what they can rightly expect, even though most don't expect this, but the only thing they can rightly expect to receive from God on the final day, when all is said and done and their life comes to an end, and they stand before the Lord and they give an account to Him for the way they live their lives, according to this fallen nature, according to the lusts of their and the cravings of their flesh and the sinful inclinations of their heart and their mind, what they can expect to receive from God on the final day is wrath. Now, wrath is one of these biblical concepts that's largely fallen out of favor and popularity in our culture. There's just not too many people that talk about wrath anymore, even within the Christian community. It's almost like it's a taboo subject. Because if we start talking about wrath, the fear is that we're going to, you know, somehow come across as these raving lunatic, you know, Christians that, you know, are constantly focused on fire and brimstone and eternal punishment, and nobody, even in the Christian community, really wants to be characterized that way. But do we have the option, biblically and spiritually speaking, to drop this key biblical word from our spiritual vocabulary and substitute something else? Like, we could say this, we could read it this way, for instance, verse 3, among them we all too formerly lived in the lust of the flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of a little bit of God's displeasure, even as the rest. Or children that He was somewhat disappointed in, and because He was somewhat disappointed, they won't receive quite as much of the pleasures of heaven and eternity as the rest will. Or simply ignoring all of that altogether and say, there's no distinctions. Everyone's ultimately going to be saved, and God's going to welcome and love everybody at the end because He is a non-judgmental, pure love being that just welcomes everybody on the final day, as many desire or want to fantasize about in terms of how eternity really is and what God is really like. Well, the reality is that the Bible describes in many more than one places that God is a God of wrath. Now, He's not a God only of wrath, as if this is His only quality, and therefore He's just this horrible being because this is all that God has in His heart. God, at the same time that He's a God of wrath, is a God of love and mercy and grace and goodness and kindness and all of the wonderful qualities that we love to focus on when we think about God. But while He is all of those things, He is also at the same moment a God of wrath. And the word for wrath is a word, it's an interesting word. It's the Greek word that we use it in a completely different way. It's the word orgy. And it was a word in this ancient culture, as it was used in context in society then, to describe a strong passion. And it wasn't necessarily connected just to sensual things. It was a strong passion expressed in any context. For instance, if I'm a football fan and I'm cheering with great passion for my team, I am showing this kind of expression, okay? But in this context, the idea is, and the best definition of wrath, biblically speaking, is a settled, passionate disposition in God's heart. And it's a disposition about disobedience and rebelliousness on the part of human beings. God does not show wrath toward planet Earth. He's not upset about the state of the planet itself, the physical planet. Even though the planet has fallen, he's not ever wrathful toward the planet. He's not wrathful toward the animals that are on the planet. God doesn't show wrath to dogs and cats and horses and chickens. He doesn't show wrath to anything except people. Wrath is reserved for people. Why is that? Because there is no part of God's creation other than, and we'll talk about this in a different context later in the book of Ephesians when we get to chapter 6, other than there's only one other aspect of God's creation other than people that are fitting recipients of wrath. And what other aspect would that be? Anybody? Angels and demons, sure. And we're talking specifically fallen angels, of course. And that's because human beings and angels and demons are the only beings that have any capacity to bear any measure of God's image. And because they have the capacity to bear a measure of God's image and to violate the image of God, that is what causes or stirs God's heart in a settled, passionate disposition against the violations of His own image, of His holiness, of His righteousness, of His standards, of what is eternally important to Him. And wrath is the, when I say it's settled, it's not just an outburst of anger on the part of God in which God just flies into a rage when someone sins against Him. And then, you know, a few minutes later, He settles down and you know, He feels soft and warm and tender toward you again. When God has reached the level of wrath against a person, it's because He settled into a final disposition toward them. But He's not dispassionate about that disposition. His heart is stirred. It's just permanently and eternally stirred toward that person or toward that angel or demon. Right? And they are the fitting recipients of His wrath. And what Paul wants the believers to catch is that we all, because of our fallen nature and because of the deeds of the cravings of our flesh that we indulged in, and because of the desires of our mind and our flesh that we indulged in, we were the fitting recipients of His wrath. Now, the glorious good news for us is that the Lord changed that for us before the time for His wrath to be revealed. Because while the wrath of God is a settled and certain experience, it's going to be fully revealed only on the final day of judgment. Now, that doesn't mean that in history God never judges and never expresses or reveals some aspect or some element of His wrath. But none of us and no one else in human history have experienced yet the full expression of God's wrath. That is coming on the final day of judgment. And so between our experience now and that final day, we have the benefit of having been graciously and mercifully rescued by God from what we deserved apart from His salvation. And that is that we were destined to experience that had God not changed our destiny. Now, what I'm using that from a human perspective, not from the ultimate perspective of what we call predestination. As far as we were concerned, before we came to know the Lord, our life was headed toward a final experience of God's wrath. And God had to intervene and intersect our lives and yank us off of that course or off of that pathway and turn us around and set us in a new and different direction in order for us to be relieved of that inevitable experience of His final judgment of wrath. Now, all of that, of course, leads us up to verse 4, where we'll start in our next Ephesians study. And that is that God has done the wonderful and awesome thing that he's done to stop the consequences and the motions and the momentum of all of this from chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. He's changed the reality that we were dead. He's changed the reality that we were under these three great spiritual influences of the world, the flesh, and the devil. He's changed the expression of the fruit of all of the fallen nature of sin that was within us. And he has done an amazing and awesome thing to give us the beginning of a new life that is meant to lead to newer and newer things that are replacing all of this stuff that was our life testimony before. But we'll save that for when we dig into verse 4 and beyond for next time. Let's pray. Father God, it is your amazing grace that you rescued us from the condition that we deserve to be identified as sons of disobedience and children of wrath. We were completely disconnected from you. We rebelled against you from the very first breath that we took. And we went further and further in that direction. And left to ourselves, we would have spent our lives in useless and wasted rebellion against you and your ways. And yet you chose to lay hold of us and to open our heart and to open our eyes and to give us new life and to pull us back from what we would have experienced on that final day. And Lord, I know none of our hearts can fully appreciate all that you've done, except as you stir our hearts in appreciation. I pray that our study in these verses would serve your purpose, Lord, to keep us focused on what you've done and to deepen our appreciation. And I thank you for your amazing grace in my life and in the lives of all of these here. In the name of the Lord Jesus, amen.